I would like to say I'll be 60 in a couple of months, and I have mellowed somewhat over the last years. Someone did ask me whether we could have questions, etc., at the end, but that depends on when you want to have supper. I don't mind. I prefer dialogue to standing up and giving a monologue, but we'll see how it goes. Just a few words of introduction. The terms used in this talk, in the title we have the notion of an imminent Buddha. It's not a term I use, but this is a term that has been used in the movement. They're talking about, you know, the imminence of Buddhahood within individuals. So we use the term imminent Buddha, but what we're talking about is traditionally known as the Tathagata Garbha, right? Now I say Tathagata Garbha and not Tathagata Garbha, not because I'm Irish, because that is as far as an English person goes, or a Scottish person, a British person, that's how you pronounce it. Yeah. I'm very finicky and I don't let people off the hook on these things, I'm afraid. And then the other term I'm going to use in this talk, it's all the same thing, is the term Buddha nature. Because if you read Zen books and the Buddhism we get from China, this notion of Tathagata Garbha, it got a bit garbled on the way. And when it come back into English, it's known in Zen, Chinese Zen or Japanese Zen, it's known as the Buddha nature. So sometimes, because I'm going to be quoting texts, sometimes I will talk about Tathagata Garbha, sometimes I will talk about Buddha nature. But it's the same thing, as it were. And the other things I'm going to talk about, say, I'll refer to the samsaric sequence of conditionality, and I'll talk about the nirvanic sequence of conditionality. And I think we all know what that means, right? I'm just going to take it as given anyway. So sometimes I'll talk about the nirvanic sequence of conditionality, which we know is the from dukkha arises shraddha, or confidence in the Dharma. From that arises joy, right through to knowledge of the destruction of the astravas. That's the nirvanic sequence. The samsaric sequence is the usual one. Independence on spiritual ignorance arises as samskaras, or the karmic formations, all the way to old age, disease, and death. But for shorthand, I'm just going to use these two terms. Now, I'm a scholar, so when I am asked a question, what is the Buddha nature? What is Tathagata Garbha? My only interest is what texts say. I'm not interested in what anybody else says. I go to texts. That's where I find my sources, right? The Buddha in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is in the Pali Canon, says, when I'm gone, you have the Dharma. That is your guide. Let the Dharma be your guide. And that's, I take it quite literally. So when I'm asked a question like, what is Tathagata Garbha? I go to what the texts say about Tathagata Garbha. And in this talk, I'm only looking at one text, a text called the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, not to be confused with the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is only 20 pages long. The text I'm using in English translation is about over 750 pages long. It's the same kind of theme, the last days of the Buddha, but we can say it's been padded out over the years. And this is a very influential text, especially in China and East Asian Buddhism. And the notion of Buddha nature we have in Zen, etc., is derived from the influence of this text. And in a sense, this talk is just the beginning. I'm only using one text. There are other texts. I don't know what they say. Well, I do know what they say, but I'm not going to go into it here. So this is the way I proceed. It's an investigation. What does this text say? And it gives you a basis. It gives you a grip on what the Buddhist tradition, at least in how we have it in translation, and in time, has come down to us and what it said about this. Now, you could look at some of the other texts and then maybe how it was understood in Gelugpa traditions in Tibet, how it was understood by the Dzogchen or whatever. And you've got to start somewhere. So this is where I start from, the sutras. So firstly, a bit of history. On the 17th of December, 2001, Subhuti sent an email to a few order members, myself included, entitled Tathagata Garbha Study. Subhuti mentioned that he had been reading to Bhante some texts from the Tathagata Garbha tradition, and out of this discussion arose the idea that we in the FWBO, or WBO strictly, need to investigate this doctrine more thoroughly. Previously, if I remember my seminars with Bhante correctly, Bhante saw this doctrine as a red herring. And therefore, it was never really introduced to the sort of standard FWBO approach to study. It was always seen as something kept at the edge, as it were. And there seemed to be the reason for this, because it did happen in history that some beings thought that the notion that all beings have a Tathagata Garbha or a Buddha nature means that they do not have to practice. they are now fully endowed with the qualities of Buddhahood. And this actually happened. We know this actually happened. So Bhante thought it could be a misleading doctrine. It needs sort of interpretation, explication. So let's put it to one side because we do not need it. This seemed to be the general idea. But also, I'm not sure whether this is from Bhante or Subhuti, it's certainly clear that a lot of order members were saying that they found this notion of Buddha nature or Tathagatagarbha or immanent Buddha, they really found it inspiring for their practice. So Bhante thought that maybe we should investigate this notion further. Maybe we're missing something. Maybe we're overlooking something. So maybe we should go back and have a look, because if it inspires people to practice, it's obviously a very worthwhile thing to bring out. And to this end, Subhuti suggested that we start this kind of on-air, sort of by email, study group on the Tathagatagarbha. But it just didn't happen. So I thought it died a death. But lately, of course, Subhuti on the last convention gave a talk on the notion of immanence. I believe on the last National Order Weekend, Kamala Shila and Tejananda gave talks on this theme. And so I've been asked to give a talk on this one. I imagine I've been asked because, you know, you do get a bit of a reputation, whether it's warranted or not, in this FWBO movement. And probably people think that I think this is sort of a, you know, subversion of the Buddhist doctrine by sort of monks who are really Hindus, really, and who got into the Buddhist tradition to undermine it by introducing this Hindu notion. And this is not just me. I mean, this goes on in all these texts. These texts, people who follow the Tathagatagarbha doctrine are always being accused within the Buddhist tradition of bringing in Hindu doctrines. So there's a lot of controversy. And it's still a controversy. A recent movement called Critical Buddhism, which has its origins in Japan, this is really asking similar questions. For example, there's a book on critical Buddhism called Pruning the Bodhi Tree, The Storm Over Critical Buddhism. And there is actually an article by a Japanese scholar called Matsumo Shiro entitled The Doctrine of Tathagatagarbha is Not Buddhist, followed by an article by a Western scholar called Sally King. And he has an article called, or it might be she, I'm not sure, The Doctrine of Buddha Nature is Impeccably Buddhist. So this, you know, this thing still continues right through to the present day. The thing is, Shiro, this Japanese scholar who is against the idea that the Tathagatagarbha is a Buddhist doctrine, is because it, to him, contradicts the basic root doctrines of Buddhism, i.e. Pratichyasamutpada or condition arising, and the notion of anatman. That is what he says. So let's have a look at the notion of immanence. So the notion of immanence, it comes from the Latin manere, which means to dwell or to remain, and the prefix im or in, right? So what it means is to dwell within, indwelling, innate, or being, it even means permanently pervaded by. Even our English word mansion comes from the same root, right? So the notion of immanence is it's something that is inherent in us. And usually the implication, especially in theology and philosophy, is that it's a permanent thing. It's something that one is born with. It's innate. Maybe the Sanskrit term might be sahaja, something you are born with, innate. So in a word, is this doctrine saying that we are all born innately with a really existent, ontologically existent thing called Tathagatagarbha or a Buddha nature? Now, we could say that the concept of immanence is not a Sanskrit concept. It corresponds directly to immanence, but the notion of immanence is very clear. It pervades the whole of the Upanishadic tradition. And this is, you know, the early Upanishads, so I'm going to use here, they precede Buddhism by probably 200 years, right? And so I'm going to say, you know, just show how we see it in the Upanishads, in the Chandogya Upanishad, which is an early Upanishad. And there we have the sage, Udalaka, and he's trying to teach his son, Svetaketu, the notion of the immanent Brahman. That's how, I mean, even modern philosophers, when they give titles to these things in Upanishads, although they don't have titles in the original Sanskrit, this is the term they use, the immanent Brahman, etc. So after Udalaka's initial attempts to teach his son about the nature of Brahman, Atman, it's the same thing in the Upanishad, Brahman, Atman, same thing. Svetaketu asks his father to teach him further. He hasn't quite grasped it. So what follows are 9 similes that, as it were, illustrate the immanence of Brahman in the world and in the self. So first of all, he says this way to Cato, he says, well, get a big container of water, then get a big chunk of salt. Now drop the chunk of salt into the container and come back tomorrow. So they come back tomorrow and he says, now taste the water from this corner of the container. And he tastes it. He says, what does it taste of? Salt. He says, now go to the middle of the container, taste the water there. What does it taste of? Salt. Go to the other end of the container, taste the water. What does it taste of? Salt. And he says, that is exactly as Brahman is in the world, right? Brahman permeates, he's imminent in the world, but we cannot see him. We see the water. And the water is like, in, you know, the world or the illusory world in some forms of Hinduism that we perceive. But the reality behind that illusion or permeating that illusion or imminent in that illusion is the Brahman Atman. And this is where we have the famous statement, tattvam asi, which means you are that. And this is what Udalaka says to Svetuketu. He says, that is Brahman. You are that. In other words, your reality, in reality, you're not your mind, your thoughts, your feelings, etc. So beyond all that, what you are in reality is this Brahman. And those who realize it are liberated from rebirth. That's the idea. So here we have a clear notion of immanence in pre-Buddhist Indian tradition. Later on in Indian philosophy, you have, because I think Subhuti mentioned something like immanent and transcendent. But again, we have this in Indian philosophy. The term is Beda Beda. So Beda, as in Sangha Beda, which is schism in the Sangha, Beda means a split, disunion. And Beda Beda means Beda and Abeda, which means union or non-duality and duality. So Beda Beda means Brahman is in union with the universe, he is immanent to the universe, but at the same time, he is not identical to the universe, he is, or whatever it is transcendent to the universe. So these ideas, I mean, people think they just have their origin in the West, but these ideas were in India long, long before we had these ideas coming out in Christian theology. But another analogy or the simile, because I like similes. When I teach, I prefer to use stories and similes because I think they can demonstrate things much more clearly than putting it over conceptually. Right? And I could say that because I'm supposed to be an intellectual. So we have another simile, and this is a simile I'm going to use because it's found in the Upanishads to do with this immanence. It's found in the Pali Suttas, and it's a simile used in the text, the Mahaparinirvana text, which is the Tathagata Garbha Sutra. Right? This is going to be the main theme of the talk. So in the Upanishads, Brahman is likened to ghee, which is immanent in the milk. And what they say is, if there was no ghee immanent in the milk could not produce ghee. Now, technically, this is known as Satkarya Vada. Vada is the doctrine that the effect exists in the cause. Where you're talking about a rose and a seed, in a sense, they would say the rose actually, ontologically speaking, really exists in the seed, even though you can't see it. So here in this analogy, it's impossible for you to get ghee from milk if the ghee did not already exist in some hidden form, immanent in the milk. It just can't happen. So I think, personally, that the whole doctrine of conditionality was introduced to completely undermine this view. So what I want to talk about now is conditionality, because conditionality is supposed to be the root doctrine of Buddhism. Even, I think the Dalai Lama somewhere calls it the Buddha's mantra. Joanna Macy calls it, she says something like, in no other religion do we have a doctrine of causality as the root doctrine of that religion. It's very strange. It's almost like, is Buddhism a religion? The key doctrine is a natural law, as it were. Okay, it's more than a natural law in a sense, but it's got nothing to do with God or whatever. And this is meant to be the key doctrine of Buddhism. When I've studied it, I divide it into three levels. There's three levels of condition arising. There's level of conditionalizing as reality. So the Buddha says in the Samyutta Nikaya, monks, whether there be an appearance or non-appearance of a Tathagata, this determination of nature, this orderliness of nature prevails, just this conditionality. And we'll see actually later in one of the Tathagatagarbha Sutras, another one called the Srimala Sutra, it actually hijacks here the notion of conditionality and replaces it with the notion of Tathagatagarbha. But elsewhere in the same Nikaya, the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha says, bhikkhus, that herein which is reality, not unreality, not other than it really is, just this conditionality, that is called condition arising. And we note here that the word for reality is tatata. So if you study Mahayana sutras, Yogacara sutras, this is a term that's often used to indicate the nature of reality. But here it is in the Pali sutras. Tatata, ta, makes a noun abstract, so it's like adding ness on the end, like empty ness, shunya ta. So tata is just a word that means thus. So it's sort of talking about kind of thusness. Things are just as they are. In the seen, only the seen. In the heard, only the heard, etc. It's pointing to something, reality. We'll just call it reality, right? So these statements regarding conditional arising, to me, they clearly point, or they're trying to point to the very nature of existence. And also in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha also equates conditional arising with the Dharma, and also, from another edition, we have the Dharma equated with the Buddha. So he says, whoever sees Pratitya-samuppada sees the Dharma. Whoever sees the Dharma sees Pratitya-samuppada. And moving back to the Samyutta Nikaya, we have the Buddha warning against identifying his physical body with Buddhahood, and he says, what is there in seeing this vile body of mine? One who sees the Dharma sees me. One who sees me sees the Dharma. So you only see the Buddha when you see the Dharma, and you only see the Dharma when you see Pratitya-samuppada, or condition arising. And in another text, probably most of you don't know this text, it's called the Shalistamba Sutra, which is available in English. It's a very early Mahayana text, what some call a proto-Mahayana text. It actually puts these together and it says, whoever bhikkhus sees Pratitya-samuppada sees the Dharma, whoever sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. And interestingly, we actually find this quote in a Tathagatagarbha Sutra we're looking at later on. But this sutra also goes on to say, and this is why I think Pratitya-samuppada here is reality, it goes on to say that Pratitya-samuppada in this sense is always and ever devoid of a soul. The word for soul here is a jiva. It is unborn, not become, not made, not compounded, unobstructed, inconceivable, glorious, fearless, ungraspable, inexhaustible, and by nature never stilled. So here we're talking about Pratitya-samuppada as reality. It's pointing to the nature of reality. And in the Pali Suttas, we have this on a more sober level, saying that the Dharma is subtle, difficult to grasp, beyond the range of reason, you know, to be understood only by the wise. So we could say Pratitya-samuppada in this sense is synonymous with reality. But then we have Pratitya-samuppada on another level, and that is what I call Pratitya-samuppada as a principle, a universal principle. And this is found in the expression, when this is, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. So this is a general formula. What you have to do to make it more concrete is you have to fill in the pronouns, this and that, you know. When this is, I arose, seed, soil, moisture, sunlight, that becomes, arose, right? When this is not, I, no water, no seed, that does not become, no rose. So this is Pratitya-samuppada as a general universal principle, which is an expression in space and time, etc., of what is, in the first instance, something of the nature of reality in the world. The first step of reality in the world, as it were. So it's a kind of minimalist formulation. But then we have Pratitya-samuppada in formulae. Right? And we have various formulae, such as the 12-fold Nidana sequence, beginning with independence on spiritual ignorance as arises the sankskaras, independence on sankskaras as arises consciousness, etc. And there are many, many more of these. There's tons and tons of formulations. Unfortunately, I may mention this later on, it is the case that Pratitya-samuppada becomes identified with one formulation. And the important formulations, as we know in the movement, are what we call the nirvanic formulations, such as independence on faith arises joy, from joy you get rapture, from rapture happiness, happiness, samadhi, from samadhi insight into nature of existence, etc. So all these formulations, they're filling in the principle. So what I'm saying here, there are three levels. There's Pratityasamutpada as reality, Pratityasamutpada formulated as a very general universal principle, and then there are the individual formulations of Pratityasamutpada, which are various. Some relate to samsara, some relate to nirvana. Unfortunately, the nirvanic ones seem to have been lost in the bells of history. This is another talk I'd like to do, actually, what the effect is on Buddhism when these positive Nidana sequences become totally lost. They're just not mentioned, you know, at all in 2,000 years, as far as I can see. What effect did that have when conditionality itself becomes identified with what is a negative samsaric sequence? There's a lot to say on that, but I'm not going to say it here. So now we move on to immanence in the doctrine of the Tathagatagarbha. In translation, anyway, there are three main Tathagatagarbha sutras. First of all, there's one called the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. It's only about 5 pages long. It's very short. I think it exists of 9 similes of Tathagatagarbha, you know, like the woman with a child or the gold hidden in the soil, this kind of thing. Then there's the Sri Mala Devi, or it's got various titles. The shortest title is Sri Mala Sutra. That's available in English. You could have a look at that. But the one I'm interested in is because it's just peculiar to me. I got suddenly interested in this text. I had it in the library. It's in 12 little booklet forms. And it comes, I photocopied it and bound it, and it comes to over 750 pages. And this is the Maha Pari Nirvana Sutra. Now, I took this sutra because it's meant to be the most influential in East Asian Buddhism. It's the largest sutra. It uses many, many similes. And that's what I like. I don't like, personally, funny enough, the more intellectual approach. These days, I'm getting old. I prefer the simile approach. So first of all, a bit of background. Well, for instance, none of these texts, we do not have any Sanskrit original. None. We have Sanskrit, the text I'm using, the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, we do find Sanskrit fragments, just a few pages. That's all we have. But to say about the texts we have, so what do we have in terms of the Mahaparinirvana Sutra? Well, we have one text called the Faxian text, which is meant to be the earliest. That was translated into Chinese from, we assume it was Sanskrit, it might be in some like Sogdian or some Central Asian version of Sanskrit, between 414 and 418 CE. Then we have another translation, which was done by someone called Dharmakshema, and that was done round about the same time. It seemed to have started earlier, but maybe finished later. Now this is the one I am using. This is an English translation of the Dharmakshema translation. It's much bigger. We don't know why this is. The Faxian translation roughly corresponds to the first 5 chapters of the Mahaparinirvana Sutra I'm using, the Dharmakshema translation, which is in 46 chapters. But we also have a translation from Sanskrit into Tibetan, but that was done in the 9th century. So this is nearly 500 years later, and that's in something like about 20 chapters. And they're very different. I've had a look at some of them. I've got a rough English translation of the Tibet one, but it's not published yet. And they're all talking about the same thing, but they're slightly different. Whether these are differences due to translations, well, I'm not sure. But the text I'm using is this big one. And there is theories, I'll just mention this, about the origin of these texts. Last night we heard about Reginald Ray, his book on Buddhist saints in India, and he talks about the monastic tradition, the lay tradition, and there's the forest nuncian tradition. And the view of scholarship these days is the Mahayana has its origins in the forest nuncian tradition. It's like it's more visionary, it's more to do with meditation, etc. They don't live in monasteries, but don't get the idea of the lay people. They're much stricter and more ascetic than any monks. In fact, they complain about the monks being too lax. So don't get the idea that we are forest nuncians. But it seems it's quite clear from the earlier texts, seeing how they progress. It's like they start with these people they're called Dharma Katikas, and they're like acharyas, they're wandering teachers. But these texts are taken up, and they're written out. In the Dharmakshema translation, they're written out, and they're replaced by monks. So that's how things go. These are the texts. And the two main themes of the Tathagatagarbha text, the main theme is that the Buddha is eternal. The Tathagata, or the Buddha, does not die. he does not actually die at the so-called Parinirvana. That's why they call it the Mahaparinirvana, because that wasn't really the Buddha dying. The Buddha just goes elsewhere. The Buddha will not leave samsara behind until all sentient beings are awakened. Well, there's a little problem here. There's a problem of people called achantikas. In some parts of the text, the achantikas are beings who have got, they're so devoid of any root of goodness, they, even the Buddhists can't save them. Samsara is left to them. But again, other people got their hands in it, especially when we went to China, and they said, well, no, the achantikas, because they've got the problem of, well, do the achantikas have Buddha nature? How can somebody with Buddha nature not gain enlightenment? So they say, well, it takes Buddhas to awaken these beings. So they get awakened, they can become awakened, but only Buddhas can awaken them. So to explore this theme, I'm using similes. And these are the similes used in this text concerning milk. Well, sometimes it's milk, curds, butter, cream of butter, ghee, cream of ghee. Sometimes it's just butter and cream. Sometimes it's milk and etc. They vary, yeah? But the point is the same. Yeah, the point is the same. So we saw that in the Upanishadic tradition, when we used this simile, the simile was that Brahman exists in us, because it's in us, it's called the Atman, and is imminent in us, and is our reality, and it's here, really, now, in a very real ontological sense, just like the ghee is in butter. So if we switch to the Pali Suttas, in the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha says, and I think, because the Buddha, I mean, I've done a talk on Did the Buddha Have a Sense of Humor, and it's quite clear that, well, I say the Buddha, but whoever wrote these texts in the early days, they clearly knew about the Upanishads. And basically, there are so many jokes in the Pali Canon that people don't understand because they don't understand the Upanishads. Now, that's another story. So I think the Buddha uses a simile with the Upanishadic notion in mind. Because you must remember, a large majority of the early Buddhist disciples were Brahmins. You know, they were the people who knew the Upanishads, they were the people who knew Sanskrit, etc. So this would have all come in, even though the Buddha didn't know about it initially, it would have come in to the early Buddhist tradition. So the Buddha says, in his minimalistic sense, he says, from the cow we get milk, from the milk curds, from the curds butter, from butter ghee, and from ghee cream of ghee. And when there is milk, we do not speak of curds, or butter, or ghee, or cream of ghee, we speak of milk. Right? When there are curds, we do not speak of butter, cream of ghee, milk, etc. We speak of curds. And he goes through them all one after another. Right? So in other words, when we have milk, we stick with the fact that in terms of what exists here and now, in any kind of meaningful sense, there is only milk. If we start to speculate and ask questions such as, where the cream of ghee is when there's only milk, or where the milk goes when we have cream of ghee, the Buddha says, you will get confused. So this is clearly, I think, a challenge on, you know, it's just the way our mind works. And he says to Chitta, the disciple he's talking to, he says, but Chitta, these are merely names, expressions, terms of speech, designations in common use in the world, which the Tathagata uses without misapprehending them. So here, I mean, just to give you how I try to teach it or try to grasp it, I say, well, it's like a rainbow. You look at a rainbow, you have yellow, then it becomes orange, red, then what does it go? Mauve, blue, etc. But you say, I would say to my students, I say, well, where does the yellow finish and the orange begin? So you get, oh, well, there's a colour in between yellow and orange, mimosa or something like that, right? Oh, well, where does the yellow start? You know, where does yellow finish and the mimosa begin or whatever? And you can just go on and on and on. And the whole point is you realise that these designations, these labels, etc., like yellow, orange, etc., they don't belong out there. They are what we impose on what is in the scene, only the scene, in order to, well, in order to live, in order to survive, in order to communicate, etc. But the problem is we think there is something yellow there that is distinct from orange. It's not the same kind of temporal process as the ghee in the milk, but you could apply it to ghee in the milk. You say, well, where did the milk? Well, when it comes out of the cow, you know, it's got a certain constitution, smell, etc. The next day, well, it's slightly changed, doesn't it? It smells slightly different. Maybe it's slightly sweeter, you know? And after a while, it becomes little bit sour, you're not sure whether to put it in your tea or not, you know, you're not sure, so you throw it out, you know, and if you leave it, it becomes sour. These things don't really exist. There's just a continual process. It's got no divisions in it at all. But in order to understand it, we say, we have ghee here, milk. Well, where does the ghee come from? You know, here we are, unawakened beings. How can unawakened beings become awakened beings? So awakened beings is like ghee, unawakened being is like milk. So somehow or other, there must be something in us now that is awakened, and we'll call that Tathagatagarbha. Is this what it means? We'll see. We'll see. So the point is that this way of looking at things, if you just stop with it, the Buddhist seems to stop there because it does not tell us anything about the real nature of existence. When the Buddha talks, he says, this being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. You know, there is continuity. But even like we say in Nagarjuna, in a sense, there is no this that becomes. It's just, even then, that's a labeling. Yeah, just more abstract, right? So this is why I think the Buddha, when he talks, I mean, it's like if you want to grasp on reality, the most minimalistic statement you can say is this being that becomes. It's pointing to something. So we go to our Mahaparinirvana Sutra. And so there's a Bodhisattva, Singhanada, and he's playing the straw man. He's playing the part of the literal-minded Buddhist who thinks there is ghee in milk. So I've got a whole pile of similes here to do with milk. So he says to the Buddha, but in a way, Lord, all beings possess the Buddha nature in the same way that there is butter in milk. And the Buddha replies, I have never maintained that there is the nature of butter in milk. When people say that there is the nature of butter in milk, it is because they see that butter is produced from milk, i.e. they see that butter arises independent on conditions. But they don't understand it. They think it comes from milk. Right? So the Bodhisattva Singhanada asks, World Honor One, everything produced surely must have its occasions. I'm not really sure what this means, but anyway, that's what it says. And the Buddha replies, Good sons, when there is milk, there is no butter, and there is also no curd, butter, or ghee. If there is cream in milk, why don't we give milk the double name cream milk? Right? Just as we call a person skillful in making both articles of gold and iron a golden blacksmith. And then he says, Good sons, if there is the nature of cream in milk as you have maintained, why do milk sellers not ask for the price of cream? Why do they just ask for the price of milk? He says, If there is the nature of cream and milk, why can't we detect it simultaneously in the five tastes, i.e. the five tastes being the taste of milk, cream, curd, butter, and ghee? If there really was the ghee in the milk, we would taste it, but we don't. Then he says other things like, Good sons, milk differs from cream in its colour, taste, and products, and the same is true of ghee. How can we say that there is a nature of cream in milk? Good sons, just as it is absurd to maintain that, a person who will eat curd tomorrow gives out a bad smell today, equally absurd is it to maintain that there exists definitely the nature of cream and milk. So this is slightly vulgar, isn't it? You said, if curds make you fart, well, if you're going to eat curds tomorrow, you should be able to fart today. And I mean, this goes on page after page. It's unbelievable. And he gives another one. He says, you know, why do mare sellers ask for the price of mares only and not for the price of colts, which will be born from the mares? So if colts actually exist in the mare, like the Tathagatagarbha in us, when one purchases a mare, one should really pay for the colt as well. And he does the same thing with children. This is a quite interesting one. He says, a man of the world asked for the hand of a woman because he is without offspring. And once a woman gets pregnant, she would no longer be called a girl. Now, if it is said that a girl gets married with the nature of a child in her, that would be wrong. Why? For if she had the nature of a child in her, she would also have the nature of a grandchild. And if she had the nature of a grandchild, her child and her grandchild would be brothers. Why? Because both of them owe their existence to the same belly. Therefore, I assert that girls do not possess the nature of children to whom they will give birth. In other words, just because a woman can give birth to a child, it would be absurd to talk as if there was an actual child there before she was pregnant. And just another one, you know, it just says, if there is a substance of a banyan tree 5 feet tall in the seed, why can't we observe in the seed at once the miscellaneous forms of sprout, stem, branches, leaves, fruit, and flowers? And I'll finish with the last one. He says, we mix the colours of blue and yellow together to form the colour green. It should be understood that the two colours, blue and yellow, do not embody originally the nature of greenness. If the nature of greenness already existed in the colours blue and yellow, why do we have to mix the colours blue and yellow together to form the colour green? And now, this goes on again and again and again throughout the sutra. So what is clear? Why is it Singhanada and a few others, they're the straw men, why is it they keep saying, but Lord, there must be cream of ghee and butter, you know, this sort of thing. Why is it? Well, clearly in history, people keep misunderstanding it. So they have to say it again and again in one illustration after another. I mean, you have really strange ones like someone says, yes, but the shadow of the tree exists when there's no light. Because when we put the light on, we see the shadow of the tree. You know. And then he ends, he says, good sons, all dharmas are without definite nature. This is the reason. If the milk had a definite nature, you could not change in degree. Because what it is milk. That's its real nature. If the ghee had a real nature, then it would not need milk to bring it into being. Because if it had its own nature, it could just manifest. It doesn't need any other conditions. So this seems to be the point. And then the Buddha goes on to say, he says, well, it is the same with sentient beings. The Tathagatagarbha is likened to a direct cause, and the practice of the six perfections is likened to an auxiliary cause. So this is bringing in later Abhidharma stuff, really. You know, there are conditions, but it's like there are different orders of conditions. You will only get a rose from a rose seed. A rose seed is it's a more dominant condition. You need other conditions for the rose. You need the soil, the water, etc. But if you plant a cabbage seed, you will get a cabbage under the same secondary conditions. You know, cabbages also need soil, water, moisture, etc. So they're just talking about what the Tathagatagarbha is this direct cause. If we didn't have this Tathagatagarbha, then the perfection of wisdom or the practice of the six paramitas would not produce a Buddha. Nevertheless, there is something about human beings that, under the right conditions, can produce a Buddha. And they go on to say elsewhere that what this is mind. I'm not sure what they mean by mind. I'm using a Chinese translation. But they say because all sentient beings have a mind. So the reason that it's only sentient beings that possess the Tathagatagarbha, rocks do not possess Tathagatagarbha because they have no minds. So that's when we have, in later Chinese Buddhism, because of the Chinese view of the world, they think rocks are mind. So there is a debate, you know, does a dog have Buddha nature, etc. So where does us all leave us in relation to the notion of immanence? So very clearly, all these similes completely reject the notion of immanence as found in the Upanishads, i.e. that the Brahman Atman actually exists like an unseen salt in water or like the ghee in milk. In the Upanishads, the Atman Brahman is the unseen essence of all things and is their ultimate and true and absolute nature, and yet is transcendentally distinct. And as I said, it's insight into this that in the Upanishads constitutes liberation. And we don't know, I mean, obviously they said this, some people have this experience. I mean, I think we should remember this. These are yogins saying this. They're not sort of Joe Blog on the corner, the street corner. You know, these are yogins. These are people who live in the forest. These are the meditators, say this kind of thing. So therefore, in answer to the question, is the immanent Buddha a fallacy? The answer is yes, if this immanent Buddha or Tathagatagarbha is understood to be a really existent thing here and now, literally dwelling within us. All these similes are brought up again and again to demonstrate that such an understanding of the Tathagatagarbha doctrine is a wrong understanding. There is no immanent Buddha or Tathagatagarbha in this literal sense. The doctrine of the Tathagatagarbha points to the potentiality to attain Buddhahood that all sentient beings possess because they possess a mind. Now, I'll add to that because I am a scholar. That is according to the Mahaparinibbana Sutra. So when I say this, it's qualified that that's what this text says. I'm not saying this is what other texts might say or what some Tibetan teachers might say or Dzogchen teachers, etc. I'm just telling you this is what this text says. We saw this Japanese scholar said the reason the Tathagatagarbha doctrine is not Buddhist is because it contradicts the notion of Pratitya-samutpada and an Atman. So, is the relationship between Pratitya-samutpada and Tathagatagarbha? Well, once again, our text makes it very clear. Good sons, that is why I teach in various sutras that if a person perceives the 12 links of conditioned arising, he sees the Dharma. To see the Dharma is to see the Buddha. And the term Buddha alludes to the same thing as the term Buddha nature. Tathagatagarbha. Why? Because all Buddhas have the Buddha nature as their nature. Then he goes on to say, "O good man, the wisdom that can meditate on the 12 links of conditioned arising is the seed that gains one unsurpassed awakening. And for this reason, we call the 12 links of conditioned arising the Buddha nature." So here it's very clear. They're saying Tathagata Garbha is conditional arising. Now, as I said, just to mention this, in the Srimala Sutra, it actually says, "Son of good family, this is the true nature of all dharmas. Whenever the Tathagatas arise, or whether the Tathagatas arise in the world or not, all sentient beings possess the Tathagata Garbha." So they're being a bit dishonest about it. At least the Mahaparinirvana Sutra is saying that the Tathagata Garbha is Pratityasamutpada. In this one, they're trying to replace it with the Tathagata Garbha. But to me, this equation here, well, what sort of level of conditionality are we dealing with here? What we're dealing with, they are equating Tathagata Garbha with one of the formulations of conditioned arising. And not only that, but the one formulation they're equating it with is a samsaric formulation. So clearly it doesn't work, because the samsaric formulation, you know, independence on ignorance arises, the sanskaras, etc. What Buddhahood is the total ending of that. It's the destruction of that round, isn't it? I mean, all that 12 links can produce is samsara. If we talk about nirvana, we talk about nirvana entirely in terms of the very cessation and the bringing to end of that. So clearly, if the Tathagata Garbha is identical with it, what can we say? The Tathagata Garbha is to be destroyed, is to be got rid of, because it's completely ignorant, etc., etc. So it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Well, if you're clever, I'm sure you probably could make it work. But I think it's problematic. Problematic. But this is my addition to it, right? This is me talking now. So I think we can rescue the Tathagata Garbha. I find reading this text, it really had a very positive effect on me. I was really surprised, because I'm sceptical, usually, not to say cynical at times. And I was surprised, reading this text, it had really quite a positive effect on me. I quite like this Tathagata Garbha thing. And this is why, because he goes on to say, "Good sons, all sentient beings are not by nature resistant to the Buddha nature. And because of this, we declare that they have the Buddha nature." Yeah. So I see this as saying, in other words, the fact that we sentient beings are capable of responding to the Dharma is the very indication that we have a Buddha nature. Right. So generally speaking, when treated with genuine kindness, concern, and encouragement, human beings can flourish. And that flourishing can be understood as a manifestation of their Buddha nature. And according to this sutra, all sentient beings, not just human beings, are said to possess a Tathagata Garbha. And as the sutra tells us elsewhere, all sentient beings possess minds. And so any being who possesses mind possesses the potentiality for Buddhahood. Therefore, all beings possess the Tathagata Garbha or Buddha nature. So I thought, well, how can you see a dog? God. How can you say a dog possesses Buddha nature? Well, it's clear, isn't it? Dogs respond to kindness. Simple. You know, I mean, animals like kindness. They respond to kindness. It's simple. That's their Buddha nature. So it's everywhere. Flowers, isn't it? I mean, if people, you know, they've got the knack of growing flowers, etc. Flowers seem to respond to some people and not others. You could say, oh, I'm not going off my rocker here. You could. But you could say, in a sense, it's a way of looking at it poetically through the imagination, that this is the nature of existence. You know, treat things with kindness, care, positivity, encouragement, and what happens? They flourish. And that flourishing is their Buddha nature coming out. And then the sutra goes on to talk about the famous parable of the blind man and the elephant. And what it says like, it sees this initial response to the Dharma, maybe likened to the blind man thinking that grasping the tail or the trunk is like understanding the elephant. But it's a very positive sutra. So it says, well, this is good because at least they are in contact with the elephant. You know, that's the thing to focus on. They've got some handle on it. It's a misunderstanding. They think it's God or whatever. But somehow or other, emphasize on that, because this is the manifestation of their Buddha nature. And he goes on to say, and this is quite a positive statement, he says, even though bodhisattvas perceive the evil deeds and errors in sentient beings, they never dwell on them. Why? They are afraid this will lead to the arising of further defilements in sentient beings. With the arising of further defilements, sentient beings will fall into evil modes of existence. On the other hand, bodhisattvas, on perceiving the least sign of goodness in sentient beings, praise them. And what do we mean by good? It is the so-called Buddha nature. Bodhisattvas laud the Buddha nature so that sentient beings will develop the thought of the most perfect enlightenment. So the message, you know, is very clear, and it's quite a good message for us. By encouraging and praising skillful actions in others, we are thereby nourishing their Buddha natures, which only manifest in response to the Dharma, or at least some kind of contact with what we call the Dharma. Even though that response might actually mistake the tail of the elephant for the elephant itself. But bodhisattvas do not focus unnecessarily on the negative, saying, "Don't be a silly fool, that's only the tail of the elephant." Yeah, they don't. Yeah, they encourage people because they actually perceive in that response the Buddha nature, that response to the good, and this they encourage. And I think this is, given the way our movement is these days, I think this is very necessary. And I'm not renowned for saying these kind of things. So let's just return to put it in another kind of context. And this time I'm going to use the standard story of the four sights. I think it helps illustrate it a bit more. So this story tells us that a previous Buddha, Vipassi, before he became a Buddha, got rather fed up leading his rather sheltered, pampered and luxurious life at home and desired to venture out further afield into the world to explore. On each of his ventures, which according to this sutta, the only sutta where this is actually mentioned in the Pali suttas, each of these sites is separated by billions of aeons. So don't take it too literally. So firstly, he come face to face with old age. Then secondly, with the disease. And thirdly, death. So what are these? These are the final links, or the final link, in the standard samsaric 12-fold nirvana sequence. So clearly, that story is telling us what the life that the Buddha lived to at that time, the world as he saw, is best illustrated in the formulation of the 12 samsaric nirvana sequence, basically dukkha. But then he saw a fourth sight. He saw a parivrajaka, which is a wandering mendicant, and who we can say represents the Dharma. Or going back to the story of the elephant and the blind man, he represents, as it were, the tail of the elephant, because the Parivrajaka wasn't really a Buddhist, but nevertheless, he represented an alternative, positive response to samsara. At least he was a meditator, a yogin, or whatever. So the Buddha's to-be response was to leave home and go forth into the forests of northern India in search of his quest. So the fourth sight links in with one of the nirvanic formulations of conditioned arising. That is, independence on dukkha, there arises shraddha, or faith, or confidence, etc., which we can say here is the confidence. Well, we could say what it is, it's catching the tail of the elephant in that response. Yeah, it's a confident response. You know, there's a going for something. We're not sure what it is. The Buddha's not a Buddha yet, but that Buddha nature in the Buddha is beginning to manifest, and that manifestation leads to a going forth. Because suddenly there's a promise of something that ordinary life does not seem to offer. And what we're saying is that this response is possible, because we all possess the Buddha nature. Or what the doctrine, the Buddha nature here is saying, is that that is the Buddha nature. We all possess the Buddha nature because we are all capable of this kind of response. But like the milk in the cream of ghee, it would be a mistake to think that, literally speaking, this Buddha nature was actually there all the time, right? Just waiting for the right conditions to pop up, as if Shraddha really exists in dukkha. Or more correctly, that liberation or awakening really pre-exists in dukkha, which is to say that Buddhahood quite literally exists all the time. But on the other hand, reality is there all the time, right? So this is another approach to immanence. Pratitya-samutpada is there all the time, whether we see it or not. That's what the sutras tells us, whether the Tathagatas arise or not. This is the nature of reality. Whether anyone sees it or not, it is there all the time. Never goes away. It is eternal. But a reason we don't see it is because our minds are under the influence of the kleshas or the afflictions, which, due to the nature of reality, in terms of conditional arising, give rise to dukkha. Right? So our minds are generally in this state, but there again, occasionally we experience skillful mental states, right? Which, because of the nature of reality, can give rise to what we have in the positive formulations of conditioned arising. You know, they can inspire us with faith. And as it were, it's like that faith must have some flavor, as it were, of liberation. Isn't that what the Buddha says, isn't it? You know, the Dharma has one flavor, the flavor of liberation, one taste. So it's again, it's like in skillful mental states, as it were, That is where, if you're going to be practical about it, that is where we can find what they say the Buddha nature. So skillful mental states, in a sense, there's more to them if you have the right kind of attitude and imagination. There's much more to them than just this formula. It's like if you're sensitive enough and got an imagination, there is something there that is pointing beyond to something far more satisfying, etc., and ultimately, say, Buddhahood. So this is kind of what I call a nice, good alternative approach to Buddha nature that you can use in a quite practical sense. And it does bring out the emphasis on the positive, the importance of skillful mental states. Because skillful mental states and unskillful mental states, they're both the nature of realities around us. If you're unskillful, the nature of reality says dukkha. If you're skillful, the nature of reality says happiness. That's the nature of reality. It's here and now. But in a sense, you could say, well, because the nature of reality is here and now, in a sense, it is imminent. It's not imminent in a kind of literal sense like ghee is in milk, because Pratitisamapada isn't like that. Yeah, but it's an inspiration to practice that the nature of reality, it is there in front of your nose, our nose, day after day, moment after moment. So there's always what you could say, the notion of imminence in the sense of there is the permanent possibility of awakening. Because insight, they say, when it rises suddenly. And it's permanently possible. We don't know. So that, again, I think is inspiring. It's encouragement to practice. When you sit down, you say, well, who knows? I must remember, just to reminisce, thinking about this talk, I was brought back to, you know, my early days in the FWBO, etc., and pre-FWBO. And because I was a hippie, the reason I left Royal Navy because I wanted to go and take drugs. And then I used to take my LSD and read my Alan Watts and Suzuki and all the Zen stuff, etc. You know, and I was absolutely sure. We, you know, lived in Morocco. We thought we'd go to Morocco for 6 months. We'd come back Buddhists. We literally believed us, you know, because our, you know, you take LSD, you have these strange experiences. You seem to be touching on reality. When I first came along the FWBO, and I remember picking up the survey and talking about what we call the developmental model. I remember about the Eightfold Path, I thought, what a load of crap this is, you know. You know, these people just don't understand, do they? But then I thought, well, have I got it wrong? Maybe I was right then. You know, because there's all this talk going on. I said, well, maybe I've been misled for 30 years by the FWBO. And, you know, you have to ask yourself these questions. I don't think I have, actually. No. But again, it's like, you know, I think this is an important thing about this kind of teaching, is to remember that there is a kind of imminence. And this imminence is Pratitisamutpada. It's got different levels. But even Pratitisamutpada is reality. That's more difficult to grasp than Pratitisamutpada is this, you know, turning milk into ghee thing. Is in front of us all the time. It's really quite inspiring, isn't it? In a sense, due to the kleshas, nirvana is miles away. But we're not always in the kleshas. And so, in a sense, it's nearer. You know, so I think, you know, one of the things was, could the imminent Buddha or Tathagatagarbha, has it got a practical use in people's practice? Well, I would say yes. I think this is just the beginning. I think this has to be explored a lot more, really. But anyway, that's all I've got to say.